Let me begin by introducing myself just in my most salient respect, which is I've been working on Middle East water issues for 2 decades with the Associates for Middle East Research in Philadelphia, but also consulting with governments in the region. And I am currently rapporteur of the Water Resources Committee of the International Law Association, and as such responsible for redrafting the Helsinki rules, which remain the basic summary of customary international law of freshwater management. Now, I'm going to speak a little more broadly than about water issues, although the focus will be on water. We all know that Saddam Hussein has been accused, with some considerable evidence, of a wide variety of human rights violations and war crimes over the years. I'm not going to speak about those in general, but I am going to suggest that, among other things, it is very likely that he is guilty of genocide against the Marsh Arabs. When you see that a construction of a 2-kilometer-wide canal began in 1992 that serves even 10 years later no purpose other than to drain the largest of the three marshes, you have to ask yourself why. When that project began, it was evident to everyone inside as well as outside Iraq that Iraq was not in a position to undertake irrigation, even assuming, which is not entirely clear, that the soils that would be drained would be suitable for agriculture. And so it seems very unlikely that that was motivated by a desire to bring more land under cultivation. That's the first point. Second point, what happened in 1991 that might have prompted this? And the answer is very obvious. It is the Marsh Arabs in the south, as well as the Kurds in the north, who rose in revolt against Saddam Hussein at the end of the Gulf War. Now, the Allied coalition took steps to protect the Kurds. They did not take steps to protect the Marsh Arabs. And it seems very likely that the motivation for draining at least the central marsh, the Kurna Marsh, and also the works on the other two marshes, was motivated by a desire to destroy the Marsh Arabs as a people rather than by any desire to develop the country, or various other explanations, or in my view, excuses that would be offered in that direction. And if so, this itself is genocide. Although it is an issue that has largely escaped notice, at least in the United States, it has not entirely escaped the notice of Hollywood. It actually is forms a backdrop, if you will, that is never developed or explained for the movie Three Kings that some of you may have seen. Those people who are trying to escape are Marsh Arabs. However, as I say, it's not developed or explained there, and most people in the United States have never heard of the Marsh Arabs or given them any thought. And so you have a very good case that Saddam Hussein could be convicted of genocide just based on his actions against Marsh Arabs, and he has other crimes as well that he could be called to account for that might also amount to genocide. Now, turning more specifically to the question of water, there is no comprehensive treaty regime for the two rivers. There are agreements between Syria and Turkey, and another agreement between Iraq and Syria, and a very old agreement that no one pays much attention to between Iraq and Turkey. No agreements currently between Iraq and Iran, or Iraq and Kuwait, for that matter, and no comprehensive management scheme, so that we are left trying to sort out these questions by turning to customary international law rather than to specific treaty provisions. Now, the first question, of course, when you're talking about water as a legal question, is Do the Marsh Arabs as a people have a right to water? Most of the existing law, whether you're talking about treaties or customary international law, talking about transboundary water management, address the rights of states, that is, governments, nations. They do not speak very much, if at all, about the rights of peoples. Although there is an emerging body of law, and customary international law, on the rights of people, particularly the rights of indigenous people seeking to preserve a traditional lifestyle, which in 1991 was still an apt description of the Marsh Arabs. Whether it would be an apt description today, given how much their traditional lifestyle has been uprooted and destroyed, is a separate question. That body of law recognizes that a people have the right to maintain their traditional lifestyle. Now, one question you may have is, how does the law define a people? And there is no very easy or straightforward definition. The answer is a group of persons who share a common identity, usually based on a common history, and who expect to share a common future. A lot of room for discussion about just what groups qualify. Usually, the idea of a people in this sense, a people recognized by international law as having collective rights, are defined by language, a common language, or a common culture, or a common religion, or some combination of those variables. And although there's plenty of room for debate about whether one group or another qualifies, I think it's pretty clear that the Marsh Arabs qualify as a people in this sense. They did share, and they do share, a common identity. Now, it's true that they speak a dialect of Arabic, and so you can say they don't have a separate language, but they certainly have a distinctive culture. Peter Clark has referred to them going back well over 1,000 years. And that culture, of course, was built around water and around life in the marshes. And that culture has been destroyed, and I would argue deliberately and purposefully destroyed, precisely because they were people hard to control and a people who had risen in revolt. International law, customary international law, does not recognize a general right to water. Governments are very leery of such claims because they are afraid that it will be understood as imposing a legal obligation on governments to provide water to people who do not have adequate supplies. But it seems fairly clear, if you turn to the law of human rights and the rights of an indigenous people to maintain their traditional lifestyle, that at the very least, governments are under an obligation not to deprive a people of the water they need to maintain that traditional lifestyle. And this clearly has been violated by Iraq. Cognate with that, you have the claims about a right to development. That right to development is usually thought of as a question of rights of governments or of states, if you will, rather than rights of people. And so then you get a question of, to what extent does the right to development conflict with the right of an indigenous people or a people to maintain their traditional lifestyle? If, as I have argued, the changes in the marshes are motivated by an intent to commit genocide rather than by an intent to develop Iraq, there is, in fact, no conflict in this situation. There could be in the future, but at present, I don't think there is such a conflict. Now, turning to the larger context, that this is a transnational river basin in which at least 90% of the water in the Euphrates comes from rain and snow that fall on Turkey, and most of the rest in the Euphrates, almost all the rest, comes from Syria rather than from Iraq. Iraq is an area which receives almost no rainfall except right around the marshes annually. The question again, how should the water be managed transnationally? Here, of course, customary international law gives you only the most general guidelines, that there must be an equitable sharing, or if you prefer, countries are only allowed to make equitable and reasonable use of the water. Now, this would bind Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and to the extent that any other country contributes water to the basin, those countries as well. And it gives you some very general guidelines about how that, how you would go about determining what is an equitable sharing. But the mechanism for determining that and for implementing that remains a treaty regime. And at some point, which is not going to happen as long as Saddam Hussein is in charge in Baghdad, but at some point, the countries of the sharing the basin need to develop a comprehensive management treaty that not only spells out what are the equitable shares of each country, but take into account the environmental needs of the basin and the rights of peoples within the basin, because there are quite a number of peoples in the basin who do not have a separate country, and perhaps it would be regressive if you did try to set up each people as a separate country, but their needs must be acknowledged. And finally, I would argue, and this will be the last point, that such a comprehensive treaty regime would have to make create institutions capable of addressing ongoing management issues, because precipitation patterns change, development needs change, etc., environmental circumstances change, and so you cannot simply freeze in time all these decisions in a single document and say, well, now we don't have to worry about this again. It's an ongoing question that needs some ongoing process of management, can only be created by a comprehensive treaty. I'll stop there.